session number 24654, Reel 5.
So Jack, if you could just start again telling me what, how many days had Brussels been liberated, first of all, when you arrived there?
I think about one or two.
Right. A
couple of days, not long.
And you were just starting at the end of the previous tape to describe
yes.
what a big city like that was like.
Yes. Well, it was, as I said, it was every main road. Crowds of people just lining the roads, cheering all the troops as they went through. And I suspect in many cases offering their favours as well. I mean, there was such relief. And of course, one of the things we were all making contact with was the Belgian underground, who were rounding up prisoners. Germans right, left and centre. I mean, some of the things one had to do was actually to protect the Germans. I mean, I should have perhaps mentioned, I had a problem when we were at Vernon, on the Seine, where I suddenly found a large group of villagers around a couple of women that they'd shaven the heads off and were tied on chairs, and I had to break this up. And I stopped it. And in the name of de Gaulle, I started. They weren't going to stop, and I said, he said this wasn't to happen. And anyway, I wasn't very popular.
Do you think they would have hung the...
No, they would have probably beaten them up. I don't think they would have hung them. I remember the RSM, it was my RSM, the battalion, he was a great chap called Jackie Horton, and I can remember him say, "That's all right, sir, I'll look after them." I think he took them off, looked after them. He and some fellow sergeant major. Anyway, as I said, we spent most of our time in Brussels, certainly at battalion headquarter level, battalion commander, CO and that, and company commanders, preparing for the next battle, which we knew what it was going to be, which was Arnhem.
Yes.
And our role, my division role, was to, as the airborne dropped, was to break out all the way along to the bridges, one after the other, including the bridge at Arnhem, with our battalion objective being north of Arnhem, Lepidol. In fact, when we got to Arnhem, the idea was we were getting on barges, we were going to go around the Rhine and then round that way round to Lepidol, and that was the intention. Well, of course, the attack up, as is now history, of course, everybody knows, the attack along the main road was delayed for various reasons, mainly because of resistance and constant breakage of the road by the Germans who were cutting us. Because we were just going up one narrow, one a single road. And so we eventually went through Eindhoven and the bridge at Grave, and eventually we got to Nijmegen, where we captured the railway bridge. My battalion captured the railway bridge at Nijmegen. And at that bridge, by this time, the airborne had been dropped about 3 or 4 days. There'd been no contact with the airborne at all. I mean, they lost radio contact. So there was no contact with the airborne at that moment. And by chance, I was at the end of this railway bridge, where Britannia Corps was, and suddenly a Dutch civilian appeared, and he wanted me to go to a bunker in the ground where, it turned out, to cut a long story short, was it was the bunker connected to the pylons, electricity pylons, where they had a telephone, underground telephone links to Arnhem. And I made the very first contact with the airborne division through that telephone link, which he'd drawn my attention to. I didn't.
So who did you speak to at the
other
end?
I'm not exaggerating, but it was a bit, not quite as simple as that. What I managed to do was to speak to the other line at the other end, which was also Dutchman, because they all spoke English, so that made it easier, of course. And he said, where they were. He said, but there are Germans in this building. I said, well, now tonight, can you get out? Do you think you could get out of that building and get a British officer to this telephone? And he did. And meanwhile, I'd got somebody else on the line, one of my chaps actually, manned that telephone, one of my section. And I went back to Airborne Corps headquarters and told them about this link and got a senior Dutch liaison officer come and sort it out, this end. So we established that link. Shortly after that, the Royal Artillery managed to make some radio contact with the airborne. But that was the first link, was this Dutch telephone line, which the Germans or nobody else knew about, because naturally, I mean, probably wouldn't expect them to know about it.
Yeah.
But it was the first link. And then we then went up, we crossed that part of between the two rivers, the Lower Rhine and the Waal, which is the river at Nijmegen, to the Lower Rhine, Niederrhein, which is the river at Arnhem, and we arrived on the bank very close to the Arnhem Bridge, and we established ourselves on that river line with the intention of crossing the river. Meanwhile, at that time, the Polish Airborne Brigade dropped, and they dropped south of the river on us instead of dropping north of the river. And
so you're reinforced by a Polish Airborne Brigade.
Yeah, they were meant to be. They were deliberately dropped south of the river. I mean, it wasn't a mistake. It was they dropped south because of what had happened, and they didn't want to drop the airborne into what was a confused situation. So they dropped them south with the intention of crossing the river. And eventually they did cross the river. The plan for that was done from a church called, in a village of Driel. Driel was well known in Arnhem circles, you know, those that were there. In the village of Driel, which was where my battalion was, and General Horrocks made his plan from that church tower. I took General Horrocks up that church tower to make the plan with the divisional commander, because it was in our battalion quarter, the battalion area, with the divisional commander and the brigade commander and the commander of the Polish brigade, airborne brigade, who was an impossible character. He didn't want to take orders from, first of all, my brigade commander, who started the whole operation, was responsible for the operation at the time, so he was enough, he was a major general, Polish major general, and I don't take orders from a brigadier. I mean, he was under command of the British. But anyway, that brigade had to be across the river, and our pioneer platoon of the battalion, which could operate inflatable boats.
Yes.
And we actually took them across during the night in these inflatable boats. I mean, that was a terrible operation.
This is either side of Arnhem Bridge?
No, it was to the west of Arnhem Bridge. The bridge was on our right.
By a long way west, or a few hundred yards?
Oh, no, I should say a mile to the west, probably.
Was the bridge, did British forces ever control the east side of the bridge?
Yes, not really, not directly. It was too dangerous to be there, but there was no Germans there either. I mean, it would be under shell fire. There was no point being on that side. I mean, because we didn't have the north side of the bridge, which is the important side. General Frost's battalion was on the north side of the bridge, and the south side of the bridge, there was nothing. There was, in fact, there was a big train that was blocking everything, the railway train, complete with all its carriages and things, which eventually was blown up. So we were south of that bridge, and immediately south of it, come to think of it, but below the embankment. And anyway, we got the Polish airborne. Right? Then it was agreed, the plan was that our 4th battalion was to cross the river, followed by us. So meanwhile, the airborne was to be withdrawn. But the 4th battalion were not told, dear, but only the CO knew. And that was the man who was the company commander I told you about earlier, who took command of the battalion, a chap called Gerald Tilley. And the battalion were not to be told that the airborne were coming out, only the CO knew.
This is the British airborne on the other side of the river.
Yes, the British, the first airborne division.
Yeah.
And so the battalion crossed, and then the following night, the airborne was withdrawn.
So the battalion went across the river.
In fact, it was
bridgehead on the other side.
Yes.
Into which the airborne.
That was the intention. In fact, the airborne came. The whole of that river line they crossed in various places, and my battalion provided the boats and manned the boats to get them across, and they came through our battalion all that night and the next day. Really, it was all done in one night and the next day, and the most of the four Dorsets that went across were captured. In fact, Gerald Tilley at that time was last seen charging the enemy with a Bren gun up his hip, you know, trying to whip up a few casualties. He was captured. He got the DSO for it, and the airborne came out through us. They were in a pretty bad way, many of them. And so our crossing was cancelled. I mean, it was obviously not going to happen because there was no point. And we were there we stayed there for about 5 or 6 days.
On that side
on
of
that
the river?
Bank. Spent most of our time wrecking that river and patrolling. And I can remember shooting up the odd German patrol that we could see on the other side of the river. Because we still had, when you looked across the river, you could still see little pockets of airborne men hiding away in little trenches and that. Waiting to cross, and there was the odd one every now and again.
Every evening, would
get over. Yes, they trickled back. There were not many. It was a pretty disastrous event in one sense, but it was. I think it was a justified campaign. It was a justified battle. I mean, there was all this rubbish about it was all a mistake. It wasn't. I mean, it just didn't quite work out as it should have done.
And how wide? Tell me, how wide was the river? You had to cross, but was it
fairly wide? Fairly wide, yes. It was.
So, in other words, it's not a river that you'd swim just easily.
Not easily, but some people did. In fact, our first contact, personal contact, was the G1. You wouldn't know the General Staff Officer, Grade One, is the senior staff officer of the division. He actually swam across the river to make contact with us, and then swam back again to get back to his regiment. He was a good swimmer, and he came to my battalion. I always remember him. And he was briefed about he swam back with a brief. Is any way you can get it? It was all in daylight, and he just did. Well, I think it was at night he swam. It was extraordinary. But the whole episode, in my view, was perfectly justified. I mean, a lot of rubbish talked about delay and that. They had no concept about what it was. It was a battle, and trying to achieve it. Of course, we were with the Guards Armour Division. They were on our immediate right. And again, we had the continual, small number of casualties at the time.
Caused by shelling again.
Yeah, mainly by shelling. You didn't get quite so many. I mean, we got a lot more casualties in Normandy because we were green. I mean, we learned what was dangerous. I mean, we knew when to duck. You knew that one was for brigade headquarters, so you didn't bother. That one was for you, and you better get down quick. it was possible to keep casualties down to some extent.
So you spent how many days, Jack, on the river?
I think we were there about 4 or 5 days, and then we were pulled back to prepare for what was called subsequently the Battle of the Reichswald, and where we were to do this attack on the Reichswald, which is the big forests,
yes,
on the German frontier. And of course, at that stage, we were now in our first steps into Germany itself. And people enjoyed that, having a battle in Germany. And we eventually then did a big battle in the Reichswald, and that was very unpleasant. It was in woods and mud. We're now talking about October.
And
the weather was beginning to deteriorate and very wet. I can remember it pouring rain. It seemed to rain and rain and rain.
So you came off the riverbank, had a short period of rest and recuperation.
Yeah, for a few days.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And then straight into a very difficult battle in the Reichswald.
Yes. That was again, I think that was back as 12 Corps as opposed to 30 Corps.
Right.
Yeah, I think that was under 12 Corps we did the Battle of the Reichswald.
What was the purpose of clearing a forest?
Well, it was a very important part of their defence system.
Was it?
Oh, yes. I mean, we're talking about a part of the what's the name line? The German line.
Siegfried
line. We were eventually. After the Reichswald, we did another battle, and we were right in the middle of the Siegfried line operation.
Right.
Very heavy casualties.
So
Reichswald wasn't so bad. It was the beginnings of it all, but the problem about the Reichswald was the appalling weather conditions in fighting this battle.
Just very bad, awful weather.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And
just take me through the briefing then. You haven't joined 30 Corps yet.
For that battle, the whole of the Arnhem thing was 30 Corps.
Okay.
Oh, yes. I mean, the whole of Crossham, Brussels, the lot, that was all 30 Corps.
And then you're back with 12 Corps.
I think the Reichswald was 12 Corps. I'm pretty certain it was.
So can you take me through the briefing process for this? You've had a few days, hour and hour.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
Yeah. Can you just stop it a minute? I think I've got the...
Okay, Jeff.
Yeah, I think as far as the Reichswald is concerned, it was more of a clearing up operation. I don't recall any sort of major battle or attack, but the division clearing up, which was in fact a very large wooded area, involving, I think, at least the whole of 130 Brigade, that was my brigade. Because immediately after the Reichswald, we prepared for a battle to clear up the line of the line of the Rhine-Maas, the land in between. And we were preparing for that battle. That was down towards what land, the area occupied by, I think, 7th Division of the US 9th US Army. And we were on the move to rest area, to assembly areas to do that battle, when we were suddenly diverted because of the German breakthrough into the Ardennes.
Ah, yes.
And then we were moved as a division. We were starting to move south. We were moved rapidly south. And we were moved down to Liège as to be a part of the defensive position, the whole of the division. And the 51st Highland Division was moved as well. So the 30 Corps was moved down to there, and we were there and remained there right through Christmas, New Year, at that period, when Monty then was put in command of the northern flank of that attack. We never actually made any, I think 51st Highland did actually make some contact with German troops. We never did. We had a lot of contact with German aircraft there. Well, that was one of the problems initially. And then the...
Can you explain that? So the Luftwaffe called...
The Luftwaffe...
Initially,
the Luftwaffe made a significant contribution. But shortly
and
after...
And they interfered with your division?
Yeah, well, I mean, we got a lot of air attacks.
Did you?
Yes. We also got a lot of V-1 attacks, because the V-1s were flying on Liège, and some of them were around Liège where we were. But they didn't really cause any serious damage to us, anyway. But they were a bit nerve-wracking, because we weren't used to V-1s.
Yes.
But that rapidly went because the weather deteriorated. And because the weather deteriorated, it actually helped the Germans, because we couldn't use the Royal Air Force. And so we went right through the whole of that Christmas period, being just outside Liège, not in direct contact, but expecting any moment to be so. The weather, of course, suddenly cleared. In fact, I think it cleared on New Year's Day, and the Royal Air Force then came in large numbers. And that and the resistance by both the Americans, particularly Bastogne and so on, broke up the whole thing, because, as you know, the German objective was Antwerp, and there was a fear that they were going to break through. I don't think they would have been able to at the end of the day.
Right.
But still, anyway, that was...
But you disengaged from clearing this forest and moving south at speed.
That's right.
Were you involved in... When something like that happened, were you involved in a great deal of planning? Or was that planning and logistics of a nature that did not involve you? You just sat and waited to get to where you meant to go?
Well...
The
planning is certainly, as far as the battalion is concerned, yes. I mean, one is involved. But we were given our objectives, we were given the march route that we would have to take, and we just did it. We would have to plan, in the area we were going to eventually end up, where we were going to locate the companies and how we would deploy. That would be done by myself and the adjutant and the CO. That was our role.
Yes.
And of course, at that stage, that's right. Then from there, we started to plan for and indeed carry out operations against north of the Ardennes in the Siegfried Line. Hello.
The opportunity just to quickly look at the war diary again. Yeah. And your planning operations in the Siegfried Line.
Well, now, our main objectives, my battalion, was Geilenkirchen.
Was?
Geilenkirchen.
Right.
Yeah. And the woods around Geilenkirchen. In fact, the woods became the main objective, as it turned out. They became well known as Dorset Woods. Because both the battalions of the Dorsets were there. It was probably one of our worst battles in both casualties and conditions. The conditions were appalling. Mud, rain, intense resistance on the part of the Germans. And we had, I can't remember in terms of numbers, but we had quite a lot of casualties. It was very fierce. It was hand-to-hand fighting.
In the wood?
In the woods, yeah. There were very extensive woods around the garden.
Can I ask what...
Now, once they were broken, you really had broken German resistance, certainly up to the line of the Mars, completely.
Can I ask what might seem a... I'm sure it's an easy question for a military man to answer. But woods, to me, seem to be a place where I'd be happy to have the enemy, because they can't see much of what's going on. It's difficult to use artillery in woods. It's difficult to do anything in a wood. And therefore, the enemy...
That's for you too, though.
Yes, I'd go round it.
No, but I mean, it's difficult. That applies to both sides, doesn't it? And it provides for vehicles too. I mean, you've got to get carriers and all sorts of weapon vehicles into those woods, and if they're in the woods, you've got to get them out. So you've got to fight through a wood. I don't think you can avoid it, unless of course it was a very small wood, and then of course obviously you go around it.
Yes.
We're talking about extensive woods.
Okay, hundreds of acres.
Yes, hundreds of acres. Hundreds of acres.
Yes.
It was very much a part of their defence system, and we had to clear those woods.
Did taking casualties at this late stage, in the latish stage in the war, especially the severe casualties, did it affect the morale? And did anyone ever say to themselves, what on earth are these Germans still fighting like this? Surely they can see it's over. It's pretty well finished. Were there any thoughts like that?
Well, I think there were thoughts. No, the first, different questions. As far as why did the Germans not think it was all over and why they fighting so hard? I think that was the case right up to the time of Brussels. Once you burst through the Seine, it looks as though it was all over. You know, you were away, and you were, and up to and including perhaps Arnhem, and then perhaps. The setback of Arnhem, the attack on the Ardennes, made us realise that, you know, there was a hell of a lot more to be done. But I think most, certainly infantrymen, I suppose, any T-SAR soldiers, in other words, infantry, tanks, sappers, gunners, of course, all what we call T-SAR units. I think many soldiers, certainly infantrymen, become quite pessimistic. You don't expect to live beyond that day. People, you accept that. You expect, well, you may well be dead tonight. You didn't worry. No point. So I don't think people were particularly concerned.
Right.
Really. I mean, you didn't stop you being bloody frightened from time to time.
Of course.
Very frightened.
Of course.
But that would pass. And you become fairly fatalistic.
Right.
Really.
Okay. So you have engaged in this very difficult battle.
Yeah.
In the Reichswald.
In
the Spark.
Dorset Woods, yes.
In Dorset Woods, I apologise.
Yeah.
Outside Geilenkirchen.
Yeah.
And we are in February 1945?
There we are. Yeah. Well, no, not... End of January.
End of January.
Yeah.
Can you, after you have engaged in this, presumably you are withdrawn?
Yes.
And to get further reinforcements?
Then, yes. Well, we would have always had a constant stream of reinforcements. But then our next big battle was to clear up the line of the Maas and the Rhine, and that's the Battle of Gok. It was really the Siegfried Line in its main strength. It was the backbone. Once that was to be cleared, that would take you right to the banks of the Rhine. So we moved up to the Nijmegen area to prepare for that battle. Excuse me. I've got a cough now. As far as we got up to the Nijmegen area, to prepare for that battle. Whilst I was there, I got notification that my parents' house had been bombed. They had a B2 land very close. It was one of the big ones of London. They were living in Barking at the time. And so I got compassionate leave to go home
right
for a bit. And I flew back from, in a Wellington actually, from somewhere in Brussels, I think, probably from Brussels, to Stansted. and went and saw my parents, and I was home for about a week while they were recovering. They were both knocked about a bit, and the house was certainly knocked about badly. And then Kathleen joined me for a week there, and we were V1'd and that. Whilst we were in London, I thought it was more frightening than being in slit trenches. I think I'd get back to the safety
of the front line.
Front line, I must admit. I eventually rejoined the battalion just before the battle which we were planning. So I got back in time for the battle itself. So we then cleared what was called the line of, as I said, the Rhine-Mars battle, which include capturing Cleve and Gok, where there were a lot of casualties, both German and ourselves. It was probably one of the worst battles of the war, as far as the British were concerned. Again, that was 30 Corps, on two divisions going down. And during the course of that battle, right, go back a bit, not too far. Certainly, I think it was while we were in the Ardennes, my commanding officer, this now had moved, it was my previous CO, the one I was telling you about, Aubrey Coe, he'd become